Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Okay, and we're going to get right into today's special guest, who is my old friend Phil Flynn from up in the Chicago and southern Wisconsin area, depending on whether he's at home or downtown. Phil is a senior markets analyst for the Price Futures Group in Chicago, chiefly an energy expert, and you see him in that context regularly on the Fox Business News, where he's an analyst for the energy market and elsewhere. And Phil, I'm glad you could join me today. We got a lot of questions.
I'm glad to be here, and I am ready for your questions. I've been prepping all morning. I've been very nervous, but I think I'm ready to go.
Well, look, you know, we've been doing a series here at the National Investor of sector updates as we get to mid-year. I couldn't think of a guy I'd rather have on to talk about the U.S. energy markets than you. So we're going to get right into it. You know, we've got a president now who wears his drill baby drill mantra on his sleeve. He wants us to be energy independent, critical minerals independent, et cetera. But we're not starting off 2025, the first half, in the best shape for the energy markets. We saw the oil price drip into the 50s for a while, which leads the industry to say, don't drill, baby, don't drill. So the rig count consequently is down to the lowest it's been in quite a while. And, you know, it's not going to last. We've already seen somewhat of a recovery as people realize that the demand situation is still strong in the world. So I kind of want to start there because I know I get your blog every day. I read it faithfully. And you've been pointing out, among others, that the demand situation is still very strong.
It is. It is. And it seems counterintuitive that the U.S. energy industry has to be pulling back at a time when demand growth is growing, not only here in the United States, you know, but around the world. But, you know, I think the energy industry is still feeling the pain really from the last administration and some of the ridiculous policies that they put in place that have distorted the market. And probably first and foremost, I would say, is President Biden's misuse of our strategic petroleum reserve. Right. When he released about 180 million barrels of oil onto the market, he distorted the market. Yeah, he was able to lower prices temporarily, but he really hurt the investment incentive. And at the same time, he fed rampant inflation with his crazy government spending, out of control spending. So he drove up the cost of doing business in the oil patch, right? And you know, you look at the cost of rigs, they went through the roof. They doubled and tripled under Joe Biden. The cost of steel and aluminum and everything was going through the roof. Now add to that the fear that you're gonna get sued every day because Joe Biden had a, you know, an X on your back. He was coming after you potentially. You know, threatening to sue you for climate change. What did you know? When did you know it? You know, environmental justice where, hey, you know, you're drilling in areas because you're a racist and, you know, crazy stuff like that that discouraged investment. And I think the after effect of that is that the market, you know, we weren't getting the high prices because of the release from the reserve like we should have. That discouraged investment. And we're kind of feeling the pain. And it's not like our inventories are brimming over. I mean, if you look at inventories, you know, we're, you know, well below the 5-year average when it comes to crude supplies, distillate supplies. You would think we would be booming, but because of those market distortions, it really hurt the industry.
Well, and I think that there's been a lot of ways in which the market has overreacted into the downside in the recent past. I mean, I love using a chart, Phil, of the oil price from 2007 through 2008, because we had two major extremes. We were at $140 a barrel for oil at the peak in 2007. It took less than a year to knock the one off of that after the financial crisis. We were in the mid to upper 30s a barrel. And neither of those numbers reflected real world fundamentals for supply and demand. It showed that all of this, speculators and people who trade these commodities, and that's part of what you do, you're one side of the boat and everybody went to the other side of the boat. And so I've been somewhat surprised recently to see when we had that one dip down into the 50s recently per barrel before we recovered somewhat, to see how people were pushing the price down, despite that decent fundamental that you pointed out of inventories. They aren't exactly huge, and demand is still strong in the world. I mean, we really haven't seen much of a reduction in demand, have we?
No, we haven't. And that dip down you're talking about really coincided with the big drop in the stock market.
Right.
We had irrational pessimism. We had, Wall Street, we had major banks calling for global recession. And why were they doing that? Because they didn't understand President Trump and his policies. They got this harebrained idea in their head that somehow if President Trump puts tariffs on America, it's going to be inflationary. And it's like, I like to say, go read a book. When in the past have we ever seen tariffs be inflationary? I mean, we just had a recent example. President Trump was putting tariffs on China, in his first term. Was it inflationary? No. Did it cause some prices to go up? Yes. Did it cause other prices to go down? Yes. Look at grain prices. They plummeted, right?
Right.
And you just have to assume on top of that, that producers are automatically going to put that on the consumer. But let's face it, a lot of them can't. They can't do it. Why do we buy stuff from China? We buy it because it's cheap, right?
All
And
right.
how does China make stuff? They send us stuff that they are knockoffs of our more expensive stuff that we produce here, right? So
Yeah.
they kind of steal our ideas and sell it to us cheaper and make it cheap and make it cheaper and people buy it. But if you have to raise the price of that stuff, nobody's going to buy that stuff. If you can get the real McCoy and the cheap knockoff is about the same price, you're going to probably pay up for the other one. So they can't pass on those costs. Now, admittedly, when you talk about steel, aluminum, it gets a little bit more complicated, but going back to this negativity, now you notice those three big banks that were calling for a recession have flipped course. And all those people that were saying the stocks were going to crash and they're going down forever and this is unsustainable, we're making record highs. Hopefully, oil will start getting the message here that the economy is good, demand is great, and I think that will stabilize prices.
Well, it should. I mean, the dollar's decline has certainly helped, all else being equal, the oil price as well. It's helped a lot of other commodities because I think we're going to see the US dollar soften for the foreseeable future based on the budget situation and everything like that as well. But it's interesting that the last couple of times that OPEC Plus announced, as they just did this week, that they're going to add to their production, it hasn't had the negative impact that the first couple of announcements did. And do you think that's because people realize that the demand side is still strong enough in the world that's going to absorb that, Phil?
I think that's exactly what it was. In fact, it's counterintuitive, today, which we're doing this on July the 10th, we had the opposite effect. We had a report from OPEC that said that they were going to not raise production 2 months from now, and the market went down. They didn't like it. And why is that? Because, despite the press reports saying, you hear unnamed OPEC sources have it that the OPEC's going to raise production to regain market share. And I'm like, no, they're not. They're raising production because demand is strong. And if they don't raise production, we're going to have a shortage. And the evidence that I get for that is that if let me ask you this, Chris, you're a smarter guy than I. If you're trying to gain market share, would you raise your selling price for your product to get market share back? Maybe you would. It's a marketing genius. No, of course not. So if they're trying to get market share, why are Saudi Arabia raising their price for oil? It's because the demand is strong. And so actually, it's kind of funny because OPEC came out with a report saying demand is going through the roof.
Right.
Whatever happened to that peak demand thing? Do you remember a few years ago?
Oh,
Yeah, we're
yeah.
not going to need, we're going to consume that much oil again. We quit investing. Just invest in wind farms. You're going to be good. Everything's going to be good. That is not happening, is it? No.
Well, you know who Scott Tinker is, I'm sure. And
Yes.
I've referred to him many times in conjunction also with one of the energy companies that I have recommended my newsletter. And they love to point out that this whole theme of an energy transition has been a misnomer to begin with. Globally, we have an energy addition. And no
Yeah.
matter what you look at, we've got a good slug of the world that is industrializing. We've got a good slug of the world can't even flip a light switch like you and I take for granted. They need natural gas, they need oil, they need solar, they need nuclear, they need everything. And so the demand for energy of all kinds the world over, including for fossil fuels, is not going down. I mean, you can make a case that maybe oil is going to plateau a little bit, natural gas is going to keep moving higher because that's got a great runway still in front of it. But we're not all going to EVs. We're still using internal combustion engines. We still need oil for all these other things. And so, yeah, I mean, you and I are going to be long gone before there's ever a meaningful decline in demand for these things. That's for sure.
And you in the mineral space, especially, right? I mean, because when you look at where are we going in the economy, you look at every generation and the people that led the global economy, the United States during the Industrial Revolution, right? We're going through a new industrial revolution with technology. And
Sure.
when we move towards artificial intelligence, cryptocurrencies, and data centers, the amount of power that that's going to be needed is unlike almost anything we've seen maybe since the first industrial revolution. In fact, the demand growth for electricity, unless they figure out a better way to do it, which they might, is going to be astronomical. And people don't get that.
No.
At least I think President Trump's energy secretary does. He was asked the question, I won't forget, Chris Wright. They said, do you think we can meet the demand for artificial intelligence? He goes, not only can we got to, because that's the future. And if you care about the country, you care about the economy, you care about your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren, if you want the United States to stay the predominant economy in the world, we've got to get going on this energy space. And if we fall behind, the ramifications for our country is just really, really dire. It really is. So we're in a war, and it's an artificial intelligence leading war. It's a data center, but it's the economy of the future. Electronic currencies and transfers, all of this stuff is going to be driven by power and electricity. And if we don't, lead the way, we'll definitely be falling behind.
Well, for sure. And Secretary Wright, and I want to get back to him in a second, Phil, has made very clear that we are going to meet this dramatically increased demand chiefly through nuclear energy and through natural gas. They're going to be the two big ones. I want to get to natural gas in a second, but before we leave crude oil, I just want to kind of get your sense of where you see the coming several months or maybe year. And I ask that because one of the statistics that I've been following, and I see contradictory ones, is that we actually saw peak oil production near, in the U.S. several months ago. We've started to roll over. The rig count is at the lowest it's been in quite a while. And again, at the current oil price, 50s was bad enough, but even here in the mid to upper 60s a barrel, you don't have people tripping over one another to spend money to increase production. What do you see in the near term it's going to take to not have oil production roll over more meaningfully in the US and kind of maintain where we're at?
My crisis.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, it's a simple answer, but whatever you mentioned, it's like oil production is peaking. I remember years ago, Chris, I used to go on the speaking tours, the money shows and,
Right.
conferences. And I would give a conference that we are not going to hit peak oil in the United States. And in the blowback, I mean, this is peak oil production, back, 99, 2000, way back then. Everybody was, oh, the world's going to run out of oil. We can only produce so much oil. And, it's a fossil fuel. And I used to, people would get angry at me, like, how can you say that? This is a finite resource. We're going to run out. And so I was trying to use an example with the water, and then I go, see, and then, but it didn't light on fire. But yeah, I mean, these people were, they were so, and my base case was, listen, okay, Prices control everything, right? You tell me that. I'll tell you this: if the prices get high enough, you will find more oil.
Oh,
And it's
sure.
like, oh no, we're running out. No, I remember when I first got on the business, they were talking about this, and I said, well, the world's running out of oil. And I was kind of a dumb kid learning the business. I'm like, oh yeah, that could make sense. And then I was talking to an old codger. He goes, you know that Canada has more oil than Saudi Arabia? And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's oil sands, right? And this is before they really developed it. And it's like, and I go, well, why aren't they producing it? Oh, it's very expensive and that kind of stuff. Well, guess what? It's not expensive. As prices went up, they found the technology to do it. How about the United States? Oh my gosh. Oh, we'll never have enough. Oh, we're doomed. We're not going to have enough natural gas. Oh, we've hit peak on natural. In fact, even Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan of Ann, I'll never forget, said the biggest threat to the United States of America is our inability to produce natural gas, and that's the biggest economic risk we have. But what happened? You want to tell me? Shale revolution.
Shale
But
revolution. Yeah,
when the
figure out how to
prices
do it.
got high enough, the pressure, somebody builds a better mousetrap. And I'll even go further. I don't even think fossil fuels were made by dinosaurs. Shh. I don't think so.
That's something that I, when I first understood that myself, it was remarkable that there's the science actually demonstrates that these things are replenished at least somewhat. It's just not.
Right.
It's not a zero-sum game, and that's a whole different
No,
subject.
it's
But
not.
let's get into natural gas
Yeah.
because of all
Sure.
the different things in the world. I mean, look, the U.S. has learned a hard way that we got too dependent on China for rare earths, on Russia and its block for uranium and especially enriched uranium, etc. But the way in which the U.S. and Canada both are in the best shape is with fossil fuels and especially with natural gas. It was only a week and a half ago that Canada checked a major box for its own national security and its economy and energy economy, especially by shipping the first boatload of LNG from Kitimat, British Columbia, to Asia. It's been a long time coming. Now they've got three other somewhat smaller projects in the works. We have a great export industry in this country. The Biden administration screwed it up for a while when it came to the export of LNG from the Gulf Coast area of the U.S., but now that's back on track. And here again, and you mentioned it earlier, Phil, with our advantage and our need to have this advantage for all of the new juice that we need to run artificial intelligence and data centers and all the rest of this stuff. No area in the world has the advantages of plentiful supplies, technology, and cost, as does North America. And so I think that long term we're going to see the natural gas price do a bit better, but the industry even more so. Now we saw it was only what a year ago that we had a 30-year low price for natural gas, from which we've recovered. What's your outlook now? I know that you're somewhat bullish on oil, especially if we get back up to higher price and get more production going. What do you think about the natural gas market right now?
Well, first of all, I want to congratulate our 51st state for their LNG export. So keep good job, guys. I love you,
Yeah.
Canada. Keep up the good work. So they're doing great. But you're right. I'm surprised. I'm glad Trudeau's not there. He's gonna roll over and get up very upset about that, right? I mean, come on, he would be fighting that all the way. He never met a hydrocarbon he ever liked, I don't think,
Very
that
true.
I'm aware of. Yeah, I mean, Canada is doing that. Actually, I think President Trump probably helped speed that along. When he started picking on Canada, they're like, hey, we better start looking for alternatives for our
He
energy,
sped a
right?
lot of things
Yeah.
along up there for sure.
He did, and I think in net positive, it woke them up out of their loony slumber of green energy and socialism and all that craziness. So where so I think President Trump, whether they join us as a state, which would be very nice, but if they don't want to, and they're still mad at us, right? They're they won the hockey tournament. They were mad we won the first game. It's like, get over it. Come on, you won the tournament. Get over it.
Yeah.
Yes, I back to no the natural gas. Listen, fundamentally, I'm very strong on natural gas. I think we're gonna have a nice cyclical move. The short term, of course, has been driven by weather, and the just the last couple of days, We had the hottest temperatures in the world, but the U.S. producers were producing so much gas that we were putting a lot away in storage. We had some glitches on some of the LNG exports, which is going to happen. But interestingly enough, the report that we got today on natural gas was the first bullish report that we got on a weekly report. So we actually saw the injection and the supply a lot lower than they thought it was going to be. So that might signal a turn in the market. And so we did put in after really sharp low. It looks like we got a little bit of a bounce here. So we're starting to layer out. But if you look down the curve, we're very bullish, right, for natural gas. And the way that we would recommend to play it on the future side, and just remember, if you're trading futures, it's extremely risky. It's not for everybody. Your hair could fall out, or you could rip your hair out. You could lose everything you put into it. Don't even think about it. But if you're a high risk taker, what we're doing on the natural gas is we're putting on bullish strategies in here, looking further out on the curve. The options markets are a little tight in there, but you could be buying option spreads for the bull side back of the year. And if you really have deep pockets and you're convinced that natural gas is cheap, you can buy covered futures where you buy the futures and sell the calls. That might be the way to play this move on the future size. So that's how we're taking advantage of it. But like I say, natural gas can be a treacherous market. You don't want to be short options uncovered going into winter because that can be very dangerous. But yeah, that's kind of the way we're looking at it. Listen, the natural gas story is a story of America, right? We were out of natural gas. We turned it around. Now we're the biggest producer in the world. President Trump is using that leverage to deal with other countries. And he's saying to other countries, hey, we have a trade deficit. Buy your natural gas from us. Let us send it to you. Let's develop these markets. Let's look in areas where we can produce even more. The big, beautiful bill, we're going to be drilling more in Alaska. We're going to be drilling in places where it makes sense. Do you think China cares about where they drill for stuff if they can find it? They keep telling us about how wonderful China is with alternative energy, but I'll tell you that their fossil fuel consumption has grown a lot faster than their alternative energy. So I think, Chris, you made the point. I mean, demand's going up, the outlook is good, and we're pretty optimistic. In the short term, rig counts are coming down, prices are high. But producers are getting more gas out of rigs. But the biggest thing, I think, for the Trump administration is when they got rid of the methane tax, right? That was killing a lot of these small producers. And I don't think, we hear about the big companies and yeah, they've got a big chunk of the production, but a lot of that gas production comes from the little guys, right? And these little guys were going to be squeezed out of business with these crazy regulations,
Wasn't that
which
methane gas the idea of specifically former Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and that global climate think tank she was on?
Right. Isn't that where she said, so she told everybody, don't invest in fossil fuels
Right.
anymore? She's telling all the big money people. But yeah, it's like these kind of, we're going to put in all these taxes. You can debate about climate change and the concerns and what causes it. But what you can't debate is the damage this has actually done to the poor and middle class. Because all of these policies have increased the cost of food. It's increased the cost of fertilizer, and it's actually led to global instability. I would argue that the war in Ukraine had an energy element to it. Russia thought they could get away with murder because Europe became more and more dependent on Russia for supply, as they went off in their green energy dreams. When you have Germany shutting down nuclear power plants, you had people closing down the biggest gas fields in Europe. All in the name of the climate change crowd. And now to flip over to diesel, we have a global shortage of diesel. And part of that is a green energy madness because we're shutting down all the refineries because, oh, we can't produce dirty diesel fuel. Okay, fine. What are you going to replace that with? The only thing they're replacing it with is a lot of misery and higher prices for the poor and middle class.
When was the last time we had a new refinery built in the U.S.? Has it been something like 30 years or
I think it's
more?
been more than that, okay? And there's been a lot of talk about building some peaker refineries. I've worked personally on a refinery deal and it fell apart. because it was hard to at that time to hedge the type of oil that we're producing. And, part of the problem here in this country is that we're producing shale oil. It's a lighter oil. Our older refineries aren't really set up for it. It doesn't yield a lot of diesel. So we don't refine it effectively. So that's why the US is exporting a record amount of that stuff to other countries because they do a better job refining the light oil. So it's kind of this situation. But if we could in this country start building the type of refineries that can handle this, and I'm working on some projects that hopefully that'll happen someday, that should alleviate a lot of the problems that we have. So yeah, a longer term energy plan, taking more advantage of what we're producing at home. And I think that day is coming, but like I say, it takes time. And when you get in the oil world, there's so many variables that can impact things. The economy, geopolitics,
Sure.
political stuff, that messes things up. But
Well,
I think over
and
time we're
input costs in the last few years haven't exactly gone down. They've all gone up.
no, that's it. And I would argue that that is another, reason why we are upset about the last administration, because a lot of those costs didn't have to happen, right? The way they
Right.
shut down the economy, the way they started to print money, right? The way they handled their geopolitics by kind of getting into a fight with Saudi Arabia and, getting into a production war with that, it was what I call energy madness. And if you think about the way, how many people did they have from the energy industry on their staff that knew what they're talking about? Their energy secretary, how much experience did she have in energy? I know she was a great dancer in these green energy videos, so she
Sure.
is good at that. And she's a very nice lady. She seems very nice. But for an energy secretary, she would have been better off to be, maybe the secretary of something else. I don't know what, but
I
some
couldn't
other
agree
secretary.
more. Yeah, I couldn't
Yeah.
agree more. Well, at least in Chris Wright, we've got somebody who's actually in the industry, knows what he's doing, and knows how to make the trains run on time, so to speak.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. Chris
Yeah.
is in the industry, and he's lived and died, the real world. And
Right.
it's true. And this is the thing, I think the public are starting is they're starting to get educated a little bit more, about energy, which is something we didn't have during the last administration. You
True.
had these platitudes about green energies and wind farms and stuff, but not looking at the big picture, like, you know what that's going to mean for you at the gas pump? Do you know what that's going to mean, to heat your home? Do you know what that's, going to mean, for inflation on food? Are you prepared for all of that? And I guess you could make an argument that if it would actually fix the problem of climate change, maybe you could make an argument it would be worth the money. But it doesn't.
No.
There's nothing that they did that helped the climate or reduced climate change. So this is why this is so madness. It's all virtue signaling. Let's ruin the economy, sell things, to try to lower the temperature of the globe by a quarter inch of a
Well,
quarter of
and
a.
I can even, and we're a lot of this never computed with me, Phil. And again, just kind of
Yeah.
like the store where oil comes from in the first place is a subject for another day, but I can still vividly remember one of the nuns, when I was in grammar school at St. Patrick's School in Binghamton, New York, explaining what a wonderful part of the building blocks of nature carbon dioxide was. And I learned
Yeah.
how trees use it. I learned how important it is for life. So I was always one that had a problem in the first place to understand how all of a sudden it became such a horribly bad thing. But I
Yeah.
digress, obviously.
Well, not really. God rest his soul, John Coleman. I'm from Chicago. They have the weather guy, John Coleman. Have you seen him before? And he was he started the Weather Channel. He really did. And then he got squeezed out of it by investors because he needed money, and he brought in some investors that squeezed him out. And he almost, by the way, a little side note, he was going to get invested with by the Chicago Tribune at that time, which was very profitable, but they backed out. They made another purchase. Trivia question: you know what they bought instead of John Coleman and the Weather Channel?
No.
The Chicago Cubs. I know. So John Coleman used to get very upset telling that story. It's like, I would have, you know. So then he had to bring in some other investors, eventually got squeezed out of it. But he was the founder. And people thought he was crazy. Who's gonna watch weather 24 hours a day? Well, Fox Weather now, I'll tell you that. You know, forget the Weather Channel because you know, Cubs, now you can go to Fox Weather. They've got their own weather channel. So they're actually and their graphics and their people and the passion from these people over there, I'm just amazed. I mean, they're taking weather to a whole new level over there. So
I
we're
agree.
excited.
I agree. Good stuff. Hey, one more thing before I let you go for now, Phil. We referred to it once or twice, but in the president's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act that he did get across the finish line by the 4th of July, which was his deadline. A lot of stuff we could talk about, good, bad, and different, but the energy part of this, I think, is something that a lot of people will come to appreciate, as much as I have to personally say I don't appreciate that they didn't do a whole heck of a lot on the spending side of things right away, long term. Hopefully that's going to be added to. But what do you think are a couple of more important takeaways that are going to help us with our energy mix that came
You
out of
know,
the bill?
I think this bill is really a salient. We can get in. We mentioned the methane tax a little bit,
Right.
drilling
Okay, that's
areas,
right.
speedlining, you know, approval process. But you know, I think more than anything, it's a signal that we don't have an adversarial relationship with U.S. energy industry anymore, right? And the last administration saying, "Hey, we're trying to put you out of business," right? And then we're going to accuse you of price gouging when prices go up. I mean, you know, that was no place to do business, right? That's, you know, what kind of country is that? That's like, you know, some kind of crazy, you know, third world country. So that was very difficult. So I think, you know, what I'm taking out of that, those are the main things. But what, you know, and the, you know, the green energy credits, you know, taking away some that were just ridiculous, that were wasted, putting that money back in it. And I get, listen, I get when it comes to the bill on the spending, I get all of that, right? I don't like spending and I don't like that spending's going up. But the difference is that this bill also provides growth, which the Biden bill did not do. Biden's spent money and discouraged growth. You know, it wanted to raise taxes and spend more. Right, and make it up for spending anytime they had a problem. And not only did they spend money, they spent it very inefficiently. You know, they spent billions of dollars on electric car chargers, and they built like two, and they threw money at, you know, millions of dollars at bankrupt companies that are bankrupt now. And they were putting money in their, you know, these pockets of these theoretical programs. And then in the last couple of days of the administration, it's like, hey, we better spend this money because they're going to take it away from us. So they started throwing money out the door. You know, they might as well open up the window. You green energy here, catch it if it comes out of the sky. So yeah, it's crazy. So when we get back to that, the big bill, listen, I'm very optimistic about the bill. I agree it could be better, but we live in a world of politics, right? We
True.
have to give and take. But I listen, don't underestimate the stock pick. Now I'm going to tell you a real quick story. I was on the air during the first Trump administration with Liz Claman on the Fox Business Network.
Okay.
They were in the shop, we were on the trading floor, and we were waiting as the president and the Speaker of the House, who was from Wisconsin at that time, you know, was bragging about the big tax cut, the biggest tax cut since Reagan, and they signed that, right? And so Liz is like, well, you're obviously bullish. This is very bullish, but how bullish are you? And I said on that day, I go, I'll tell you this, I think the stock market could double. And she's like, whoa, you know, could it, you know, that's a big call. I'm going to hold you to it. Well, let's go back to where we went after the Trump administration. The stock market did double. It did. In fact, it more than double. I undersold it a bit. So you're going to think I'm crazy that I think this bill could be the catalyst for the stock market doubling again. That's what I'm saying. I think that we are so on the right track. We have people in charge that understand business, understand how to grow the economy. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, one of the smartest guys I've ever seen, other than you. You know, you guys are tied. Maybe we could have like a TV show where you could have like one of those question and answer, and we'll
That'd
see
be
who wins.
fun.
But between the two, you know, kind of like the old game shows, right? But yeah, I mean, and they know what they're doing, you know, as far as these tariffs. And the way that they respond, tariffs aren't inflationary. It was a Great Depression. Yeah, I'm sure inflation wasn't the problem, right? And so you get back to it. It's just nuts. So that's why I'm very optimistic. I think this bill is going to provide a big boost, and that's why I think you're seeing record highs in the stock market today. I think that's a big part of it.
Well, and the most important of those points you made, Phil, I think, as we close, is that there is not an adversarial relationship between this administration and business generally and the energy economy specifically. And sure, we've got too much debt, but when you've also got some really turbocharged growth initiatives that this administration is going to unleash, we all keep our fingers crossed and hope the strategy works that we do have. That real substantial economic growth that I think could very well be in the cards. So, Phil, I appreciate your time today, folks. On
Me
the
too.
show
Thank you,
notes,
sir.
look at the link there for Phil's daily blog. I encourage you to sign up for it. I get it. I read it every day faithfully. And if beyond the plain vanilla type of things like ETFs or stocks, you want to look at energy as more of a trader, you definitely want to get a hold of Phil, and I'll have his contact information in there as well. So, Phil, thank you so much, and we'll have to
Thank you,
do this again
sir.
one of these days.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Take care. All right.
Right. Thank
Okay, my thanks to Phil Flynn, who I hope to be seeing in the not too distant future on my way up north shortly. He's a guy that I turn to time and again, and once more, folks, before we move on, I want to stress that look at the show notes. I'm going to have the address for Price Futures Group's website and an important disclosure there for Phil's role, but also a link to sign up for his free daily blog, which I get. And as I said, I read faithfully good information and intelligence on oil, natural gas, sometimes coal, but of course, more broadly on U.S. energy. Now, before I get into some general market news and some potentially blockbuster Federal Reserve news that was percolating as we started this weekend, I want to spend just a minute on the big news that came out Thursday. Now, concurrently with this episode of Your Money Today, I have a new video interview out with my old buddy Curtis Moore, who's Senior Vice President of Energy Fuels. And little did either of us know, maybe he had an inkling of this, I don't know, but by appearances, neither of us were prepared for what came less than 24 hours after he and I sat down and recorded our interview on Wednesday. And that was Thursday morning's news of the Pentagon's major investment in a company called MP Materials. The MP, of course, stands for Mountain Pass, the big rare earth elements mine out in California. And this is huge news on a couple of counts. Now, before I get to the punchline, you need to remember two things. One is that the federal government generally, and a lot of the people within the federal government, and this has been true under both Democrat and Republican administrations, they're not always the brightest bulbs out there. You've got career bureaucrats. Sometimes they have more knowledge on the industry that they're policing than in other cases. Generally speaking, I will say that I've got a lot more faith in Team Trump on these things than I did on Team Biden. But that said, just because the government, whether it's the Energy Department, the Defense Department, invests in something, doesn't mean it's the best economic deal for anybody or the best economic project that the government couldn't be investing in. They've got a long track record of being really stupid with, now some will call it taxpayers' money, I call it Federal Reserve credit, whatever. So keep that in mind generally, number one. Number two, also remember that once upon a time, Molly Corp, as this company in California was once known, had a lot of money shoveled into it, went down a black hole, nothing ever came of it. The company had to go bankrupt, came back again. But that said, the government clearly understands in this area, especially of rare earth magnets, other finished products, etc., that we cannot stay any longer vulnerable to China on these things. Every time you turn around, President Trump is claiming a quote deal with China. There is no deal right now with China. There's a reinforced truce that they hammered out recently. That's about it. And one of the major cudgels that China is holding over America's head that they beat us with, as it suits them, is this monopoly that the country has built up over a period of time on finished magnets, rare earth products for both commercial and defense needs. And the government has said, look, we need to be aggressive and proactive and make sure that sooner rather than later we get off of that dependency. And so that leads me to looking at the terms, and I will have also in the show notes, excuse me, a link to a couple of the more representative stories on this for those of you that want to roll up your sleeves more. I will also be talking about it more in a couple different contexts in the days and weeks ahead because this is very big news. And the part of it that's really big news is this, that in order to make this whole investment on the part of the U.S. government work, in order to make it work for the company, for the taxpayers, for our energy independence and so forth, the key part of this, and I talked with Curtis afterward because, of course, Energy Fuels had a huge jump in its stock price too, in sympathy with this and with this clear objective on the part of the federal government. They are guaranteeing for, I think it's the first 10 years, a price for NdPr. I won't try and pronounce it, but it's a major rare earth oxide feedstock that is turned into magnets. They're guaranteeing a price of $110 a kilogram to MP Materials that is roughly double the current market price. And that market price currently, globally, of course, is skewed to the downside by China, sometimes in these industries, deliberately losing money at the present time in order to squeeze everybody else out of these industries. So that to me is huge because I have said, and I'm also, you got a lot of homework this weekend or in the next week, I'm also going to have a link to a presentation I did back in May for the New York section of the SME, their Critical Trends in Mining Finance that I was at and spoke at. And this was about the cause that you've heard me mention more than once of a national infrastructure bank and the fact that I saw the Trump administration falling behind further where China's concerned because permitting reform to help get a lot of things, whether it's for nuclear energy, basic materials, energy, generally whatever in the U.S., needs to be kickstarted with economics, not just permitting reform. And I explained all the reasons why, explained why I still believe more than ever that an initiative like the National Infrastructure Bank is very important in this regard. But now, lo and behold, we have one major move on the part of the federal government to address the economic aspect of these things and make sure that we are not going to be beholden to China. We're not going to base our values and economics and national security on an artificially low price that's set in China. So again, this is huge news. You're going to hear me talk about it more and more. Okay, now we're going to get into the broad stock market, the economy, what's going on those fronts, a little bit about tariffs and whatnot before we get to, again, that potential blockbuster development concerning the Federal Reserve. Of course, I'm recording this on Saturday morning, adding this to the conversation with Phil and so forth, and we'll have it out on social media and my YouTube channel and everything before mid-afternoonish time frame on Saturday. God only knows what we're going to hear by by Monday morning. A lot of times these things come out over the weekend, just as is in the case of speaking of tariffs, the president, after the markets closed yesterday on Friday, came out with more tariff announcements, higher than expected, in some cases 25% across the board for Malaysia, Japan, and South Korea. That's on top of the threatened 50% against Brazil. And of course, that is and especially the president's detractors would say this, the flimsiest of legal grounds, and this is for a president who still has got a court fight coming up on just how far he can go with these tariffs and what the legal justification is that he can hang his hat on or can't hang his hat on. Where Brazil is concerned, of course, a lot of the reason for a much more onerous tariff rate on Brazil is that he doesn't like the country's politics right now, specifically causing a lot of grief for Trump's friend, Jair Bolsonaro, who is the former president who is being investigated or prosecuted or whatever by the Lula government down there in Brazil right now. Of course, we still got China hanging over our heads. The president came out with 35% tariff announcements against Canada. In most cases, still some things fall under the USMCA that won't get hit that hard. But you know, here again, and this is one of the remarkable things this year, except for April, when we had that big drop in the stock market and a lot of hand-wringing and so forth over President Trump trashing the global economy, causing a big reversal in demand and so forth, when his so-called independence, big beautiful hot dogs, apple pie, whatever day came out back in the spring. Save for that, we have seen the stock market come right back up, make new highs in the recent past. It's got a little bit queasy again finally this last week based on these new and renewed tariffs. But it goes to show that at least my base case that I articulated even last fall, let alone at the beginning of 2025, is something, right or wrong, and we'll see how things evolve, is being embraced by the markets. And that is that despite the tariffs, despite a lot of the uncertainty, despite a president who is this today and something different tomorrow, the markets still have got this blind faith and confidence that we are going to have, even at the expense of still higher inflation and interest rates, we're going to have at least an inflationary growth cycle that might get reinvigorated a little bit. Now, on that, and here again, I don't quibble with that necessarily. I said last fall that we will probably have higher inflation and interest rates, and now we may get that in spades if what is coming out about the Fed is true. But we're going to have higher inflation and interest rates, arguably, than we would have had Kamala Harris and the Democrats been elected last year. We're going to get a much better economic growth potential as well. And again, as we said earlier, where Phil is concerned, and the most important takeaway from my conversation with him is that we have a government that is going to be a friend, aggressively so, to business, because it knows that if it's going to have any chance at all of not completely wrecking in one dramatic final way America's finances and fiscal picture, it's going to have to do a lot of things to really reinvigorate growth, broaden the tax base, etc. That part of things, Trump 2.0, I'm all on board with. Don't ever get me wrong on that. That is a different thing, and I think that they continually underestimate, as do the markets, just how nasty that's going to be. And that leads me into the main point that I want to talk about in the few minutes left I'm going to take for today, and that is the bond market, the Federal Reserve, and a looming change potentially at the Federal Reserve. Now, President Trump, and I've said this, you've heard me say it repeatedly in the recent past, has been carping almost daily about Jerome Powell refusing to lower interest rates. There's this debate, most of which is inane, in the financial press over whether the Fed chairman, rather, Jerome Powell, is correct or not on the inflationary impact of tariffs, on his reading the tea leaves of the economy. And I'm here to tell you again that while all of those things do matter as far as Fed policy is concerned, the one thing not addressed nearly enough by most of the talking heads out there is the key reason why interest rates are still high, why the Fed has refused so far to lower short-term rates, and why long-term treasury rates in the market remain stubbornly high. In fact, they were ticking higher again as we ended this last week. Caroline Leavitt, the president's press secretary, you saw this maybe a couple of weeks ago or so, she had this list that was a copy of what the president actually said. It's a fire marshal Jay at the Fed. This list of all these countries on the planet who have got lower interest rates than the U.S. does, and why doesn't Jerome Powell get with the program? Well, I'll give you about 60 trillion reasons why Jerome Powell doesn't get with the program. Somebody needs to remind Caroline this, as well as her boss. And those 60 trillion reasons are the number of dollars that the U.S. will be in debt in the next decade, thanks to the president shoving through this one big, beautiful baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, MAGA, and the flag bill, as he managed to do, you know, kudos to him politically at least, by that July 4th deadline recently. Now, maybe I'll be all wet, as will the other critics of this whole big government monstrosity, if the president actually does get Congress to come on board with meaningful spending cuts. And in fact, on that score, as the week ended, the president was threatening Republicans now who refused to support a second attempt, which was pulled by both the House and Senate earlier, to cut a lousy $9+ billion in this new spending cut program, or renewed spending cut program, that is going to be going through Congress now. And now, guaranteed, if they do pass this in the House and the Senate, they'll be acting like they just cured the deficit and the debt for forever, which is, of course, nonsense. It'll be a photo op, but it'll be better than nothing. But here again, all of that said, and I've talked about this a number of times in the recent past, the ability of central banks the world over to keep interest rates artificially low as they finance and or roll over record amounts of debt is pretty much played out. Again this last week, and I posted this on social media a couple of times, as well as to our audience otherwise, Japan's bond market again was starting to come unhinged. We saw their long-term rates in the JGB market get back above 3%, which for them is a huge move, coming from zero and sub-zero as they did in fairly short order. And once more, you need to keep in the back of your mind, as do all of these policymakers, the fact that no, it doesn't mean that the U.S. is going to go down the toilet tomorrow. No, it doesn't mean we're going to default on a debt. It does help when you look at this debt blowout and the behavior of the Treasury market. It goes hand in hand with that, that we've seen the worst first half performance of the U.S. dollar than we've seen in over 50 years. And of course, that is something that President Trump, if he has its way, is going to happen in spades. We will have a much cheaper dollar. We'll still have chronically high interest rates. You know, whether, and I've talked about this lately, whether they do sooner rather than later try some kind of yield curve control or other gimmick, we don't know. And that's my cover story in this weekend's new issue of the National Investor, actually, is talking about that subject once more. But here again, you've got these 60 trillion reasons, give or take, going forward for, you know, 10 years from now, and that's a number of dollars that we're going to have in the national debt. And that does not coexist with this idea, especially with inflation still, you know, intractable, that you can expect to wave a magic wand and the markets are going to want to settle for less of an interest rate going forward, to account for the higher sovereign risk, the higher term premiums that the markets are going to demand, and so forth. But all of that said, you know, President Trump has proved more than once that, you know, the math, as I talked about it all this year so far, let's do the math, the hell with the math. I want what I want, and I want it now. And so it shocked a few of us late yesterday to see Mr. Pulte, Bill Pulte, whose namesake, of course, is the public company that's a big home builder, and now he's got something to do with running Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on the government's behalf. But he came out and said last night, and you already saw me circulate this on X, that, I hope it's true. I'm paraphrasing, of course. Gee, I hope it's true that Jerome Powell is thinking of resigning, because that'd be great. Now, I don't know who it'd be great for. It'd be great if you want to have the dollar go down even more and have the bond market rebel even more, I suppose. But here again, President Trump wants what he wants. Doesn't matter to him that the debt is where it's at because he's insistent that we're going to grow out of it. We're going to have the golden age of America, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe he's got other things up his sleeve, as I've talked about, whether it's the gold at Fort Knox, whether it's securitizing and mortgaging, national parks and so forth. Who the hell knows with this guy? But this is a potentially blockbuster development if, and Powell has been insistent, maybe this is all a ruse, I don't know. Powell has been insistent that he's not going any place before his term as chairman at least expires next spring. Now, I don't expect him to stay around because his term on the Federal Reserve Board beyond his chairmanship goes until 2028. And there's no way in hell after especially all of this from Trump that he's going to step down as chairman but stay on the board. He will resign at that point. But if he does it sooner and the markets get a whiff of, whether it's Hassett, whether it's Warsh or whatever yes man that President Trump wants to put on the Federal Reserve, who will be more duty bound and reduce interest rates, yeah, we could see the stock market do handsprings. It's going to be at the expense of the dollar in debt, but we certainly nobody's going to want to be short anything, at least for a while. If this evolves the way these rumors going into the weekend suggest. So again, there may be something to it, there may not. I wouldn't expect Pulte to put out something for public consumption the way he did otherwise. And here again, but people don't understand that are pining for this change is that let's say that the Fed itself, whether it's under Powell or somebody else, does lower interest rates sooner rather than later. Of course, they meet again the last week of July. Most people don't expect a rate cut then, even though a couple Fed heads have come out and said, well, maybe we will, maybe we won't. It's more that maybe we won't. September is probably the most likely time that it would start, and again, whether it's under Powell or not. But don't forget that the only parties that will be helped by this will be number one, the Treasury, because and Treasury Secretary Bessent has already admitted this, there's no way the Fed wants to issue new debt or refinance old debt at what the current market is for 10 and 20 and 30 year paper, because that is onerously high. They don't want to be paying 5% for the next 30 years if they can somehow fudge their way through all this and get away with it. But if you can knock short-term rates down a fair bit, that will save some interest payments. So the Treasury will benefit and the debt will be less bad than the ugly picture we've already got. The financial sector will love this because it'll steepen the yield curve. We could see, they were talking at the end of this week that the difference between the 2-year Treasury note and 10-year Treasury note was back over 50 basis points or something like that. It'll go way steeper than that if you see the Fed, especially if they do it hurriedly or under a new chairman. You will see a much greater steepening of the yield curve. And so bank stocks are already responding to this, other financial-related stocks, because when you're going to be able to borrow at even lower rates than they are currently and reinvest or lend it out at higher rates, you're going to be swimming in money if you're in that business. Again, as I said a minute ago, you're not going to want to be short commodities pretty much of any kind. You're not going to want to be short the stock market for a while, because this will all be that rocket fuel or jet fuel for risk assets. And even though it means the bubbles will get more stupid, they will get more stupid, believe me, if this does come about. The loser in all this is going to be Joe Sixpack and Sally Soccer Mom, because contrary to what Pulte said in his post, mortgage rates will be very unlikely to come down. They will be much more likely to rise because the market will not like this. And at least the bond market is going to punish treasuries. We will have more of an environment like we did in the 70s, where sure, if you're in stocks, if you're in commodities, gold, energy, whatever, you're going to make money because of the weaker dollar and the more aggressive inflation by the Fed. But the odd man out will still be treasuries. And how long the market will be able to tolerate that remains to be seen. I don't think, at least right away, that the Treasury or the Trump administration more broadly will try and step in front of that train right off. with some kind of yield curve control, because again, for now, they seem to be hoping that, as we've seen happen for a lot of years, if the Fed cuts short-term rates and indicates that there's going to be more of that to come, that the market will feel duty bound or be panicking that they're going to miss out on something if they don't also buy the long end. And I think the big nasty surprise that would come from this, maybe not right away, but eventually, will be that as the Fed cuts further, the short-term interest rates on federal funds and the discount rate and so forth, the long interest rates in the market will actually rise, and the bond market will be punished. And that's something that the markets that will be bullish otherwise for everything else won't be able to ignore forever. But there will be, I think, that initial euphoria. So stay tuned. Who knows if come Monday morning we've seen a resignation from Powell, or again, whether this is all a smokescreen and it's just going to be the public carping by the president that tries to drag the Fed ultimately into lowering rates. But this is going to be an interesting and maybe a hot summer to watch all this stuff, folks. So don't go too far. Thanks for your time and tuning in today, and we'll be back with you again before too much longer.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to Chris at nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.